And tonight on Coast to Coast, we will talk about the Watchers series, the very secretive Nephilim. What is going on? Is there a cover-up? In a moment, L.A. Marzulli and Richard Shaw, the producers and directors of the Watchers series, joins us on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. Two special guests for you tonight now. One, of course, you know very well, L.A. Marzulli. L.A., of course, is an author, lecturer, filmmaker. He has penned at least 8 books, including the Nephilim trilogy. He's received an honorary doctorate degree for the series from Pacific International University. He has lectured on subjects of UFOs, the Nephilim, ancient prophetic texts, and so many more. Let's say hello to L.A. Marzulli. Lynn, welcome.
Thanks, George. Great to be here, as always.
Oh, I'm looking forward to this. And, of course, your partner, your director, Richard Shaw, producer as well. His body of work encompasses television broadcast productions, feature films. He has directed award-winning video series, of course. We have talked with him about the Torah codes. I'm apparently in that. Welcome, Richard Shaw, back on Coast to Coast. Hey, Rich.
George, it's really a pleasure to be here, and thanks for being in Watchers 10. It was wonderful.
I had a great time there. You know, I was in the St. Louis at the time we were doing this, so we hooked up by Skype, but that was fun.
Yeah, it was great. It was like you were in a secret location.
I was.
It was cool.
Very secret.
We loved it.
We're going to just open up our conversation to both of you, so you just jump in, each of you, anytime you want. But, L.A., tell us about the beginning of Watchers 10, which has to do a lot with DNA, Watchers 10 DNA, as a matter of fact, what you call it.
Well, you know, we were down to Paracas, and this, of course, is in Watchers 6. And the reason why we went down to Paracas, Peru, Brian Forrester, I know, has been a guest on Coast. I saw this video on YouTube, and here's this guy in this hole-in-the-wall museum. I had no idea where he was. I just knew it was in South America, in Peru someplace. I'd never been to Paracas. And Brian's holding these elongated skulls. And I just went, you've got to be kidding me. And he's going, come on down to Paracas. So, you know, I sent him an email, and things just ramped up from there. And we led our first expedition down. Of course, Richard filmed everything. And Brian was our host and our guide. And we went on these impossible treks and ran all over Peru. But Paracas was incredible because, and this really opened up some of the can of worms, because when we came out with Watchers 6 and, of course, On the Trail of the Nephilim, it was a controversial film, controversial book, and there were people that were just maintaining that all these skulls were cradle headboarded, this was results of cradle headboarding, that nothing you see here, mm-hmm. Everybody go back to sleep, and we basically maintain, okay, yeah, we get it, some of these things are cradle headboarded, and I understand that, and cradle headboarded is when you take an infant and you wrap material around, you place some boards on the side or the front or the back of the child's head.
Gosh, it's like torture, LA.
Well, it basically is. And you shape the skull. We get that, and we've seen that. However, we maintain, and that was our hypothesis right from the beginning, that some of these skulls were not. They were not the result of cradle headboarded. They were, in fact, perhaps genetic. And so, of course, the late Lloyd Pye, again, another Coast regular.
Yep, and pioneer.
And pioneer, absolutely. Was able to get out some small bone samples. Now, how we got these out, I don't know, but from the Paracas Museum. And we had a geneticist, Brian, I should say, and Lloyd Pye had a geneticist who tested these, and he wrote an email, which Brian posted, and it went viral, and the firestorm it created was just, I couldn't believe it. Instead of people flocking down to Peru, it was, oh my gosh, you know, they're stealing antiquities and it's bad archaeology. Okay, so they didn't follow the protocol. We're talking about a size of material here, basically the size of a quarter. That's according to what I've been told. That's what the late Lloyd Pye took out. A little sample, mm-hmm. And they did some preliminary DNA testing. I have talked to the geneticist, who, by the way, and we'll get to this in a second, but I spoke to the geneticist, and the geneticist basically stated that whatever the mitochondrial DNA, which comes from the mother, was completely unknown. It was unlike anything he'd ever seen because of the mutations in it. It wasn't Homo sapiens sapien. It wasn't Neanderthal. It wasn't Denisovan. It was unlike anything. And he was really stymied and perplexed by this. Well, you know, I spoke to this geneticist, and we'll just call him V, numerous times. We Skyped several times, and our intention was to go back to Peru and, of course, obtain samples legally and test them. It's been a three-year process. We still have not been able to get the bone that we want out of Peru, but we were allowed to take hair samples. And because hair is not, you know, as long as there's no scalp attached, you can take all the hair you want, basically. So we had hair samples, and we tested those. And on top of that, George, there was a mysterious skull, and this came through Richard. It was just so serendipitous the way it came to him. We call it the Oregon skull. It was in a private collection, had been for literally decades up in Oregon. And this gentleman allowed us to take DNA from that skull. So we basically had five samples that we tested at three different labs. Out of the three labs, two of them will not come on the record. I mean, they'll write reports, they'll tell us what we have, they'll give us all the results of the testing, but they don't want to come on the record. They want to remain anonymous.
Why? The integrity of the lab? Are they afraid of something?
They're just afraid of the ridicule.
Okay.
Yeah. But the lab in Canada, interestingly,
some are afraid of losing their jobs too, I believe, George.
For telling the truth, Richard?
That's my understanding of it. I mean, some of them are truly afraid that if they don't toe the line, the normal scientific community, if they try to go step beyond that, they could actually lose their position.
Wow.
And here's, since we're into the cover-up part of it already, the geneticist working at a high-end lab, I opened up dialogue with them, letterhead stuff, told them what we wanted to do, certainly willing to pay for everything up front, the whole deal. And this geneticist, V, was warned by his superiors not to do any independent testing or any testing at all on the elongated skulls. That's what he was told. So they shut us down. They weren't interested in samples. They didn't want to take our money. So this guy had samples from other people that had been sending him small little pieces of hair and bone from mm-hmm. Bolivia. And he was telling us the result. Anyway, they found out he was doing testing on the elongated skull on his own time with his own money, but using their lab, and he was promptly fired.
Wow. What a loss. What a loss.
Unbelievable.
All right, and Richard, how did the skull get to you?
Well, that was kind of interesting. You remember the UFO International UFO Congress that's held every year in Arizona. I was premiering Watchers 8.
Is that the one we gave you an award?
That was 7.
The year after that.
Okay.
No, that was Watchers 7.
All right.
Where I got to come up and shake your hand.
Yeah, it was fun.
Great. But it was the year after that. We had Watchers 8, and I was in the back just getting the Blu-ray disc, giving it to the guys there, the AV guys. And in my hand, I had a replica of the baby mummy skull that Joe Taylor had done, and I picked up from him. And I wanted to show it to the crowd because they always want you to go up and introduce your film.
Yeah.
So I was about to do that, and I was showing it to the AV guy in the back, and he goes, "Oh, I have a skull."
The AV guy said that?
Yeah. I said, "What?" And he whips out this big, phone with a big screen on it and pops it up, and there's this gigantic skull. I said, "That looks like a Paracas skull." He said, "Well, I don't know what city it's from, but it's from that general area," because by this time, both L.A. and I had seen so many skulls from Peru. I mean, this is like the old hat to it.
Sure. Literally.
We've gone through graveyards. We've gone through caves. We've done about everything. You know, me with a camera in L.A., can't believe what we're actually seeing. But I said, "Well, would you mind?" I said, "We've been trying to get samples for genetic testing out of Peru for the past 12 months, and we're just covered in red tape. We can't seem to be able to get just a tiny sample out other than hair. They don't seem to care if you take hair out, but bone samples is another story." And he goes, "No, I don't have a problem with that." So I immediately call LA. I said, "There's a guy here with this gigantic skull," and we sent him a picture of it, emailed it to him, and it's shockingly huge. I mean, it's almost as big as the really famous skull that's at the Ica Museum, mostly referred to as the Chongo skull, that has this massive head, it's huge. This thing is kind of like that, except the face of this particular skull is sloped back at about, I don't know, a 30-degree angle. I mean, you couldn't, it has nothing to do with cradle head.
I mean, these things just don't, Richard, they don't look human to me at all.
Well, no, I mean, they're definitely some sort of hybrid. I mean, any thinking person would look at that and go, well, this can't be cradle headboarded because there's too many other things involved here that just beyond the skull itself. So that was where we went. We went up to see this skull, and it came from La Arroya, Peru, which is one of the most polluted areas in the world. Formerly had, there was a mining operation going on there, but the skull was found decades ago and brought into the United States probably back, I don't know, L.A., what do you think, the 1930s?
Yeah, I would say probably the 30s. And you remember, you know, the 30s, there's no TSA. So the backstory here was this guy's grandfather was a medical doctor, and the medical doctor had a brother. And this brother was an engineer that traveled the world and did building projects. So what we surmise, and we've done due diligence, we've contacted the family, nobody knows anything. So the only thing we've been able to cobble together of the story was that this engineer of the grandfather, this guy's brother, saw this thing and said, well, my brother's a doctor. He might be really interested in this thing. Put the thing in his suitcase, and off he went. These are in the days where you could do that, no TSA, and nobody cared, quite frankly.
Lots more personal freedom. And also, apparently, the skull came from a museum at one time because it was coated. You know, back then they would shellac these things to make them look prettier, and then they would write on the forehead some sort of donation of where this thing was found, and it says in red letters La Arroyo on its forehead. So that's very much the same way the Chongo skull is marked at the Ica Museum. It's written on its forehead.
Well, you know, so, in this elongation process of a human baby, I could see moving the skull a little bit in its formative moments, but I mean, like the picture on the cover of Watchers 10, I assume that's a real picture, isn't it?
That's the actual skull that we're talking about right now.
I mean, that is a huge, huge skull difference. I mean, you can't elongate a skull like that.
No, you would basically kill the person. And Richard said it goes back at a 30-degree angle. I would say right from the brow ridge, if you just take your hand and rub where your eyebrows are, that's the brow ridge. That thing goes back at a 45-degree angle, and there's no way you can do that. And what's interesting here, too, and we had an archaeologist who contacted us and actually comes on the record in Watchers 10 and also in the book Nephilim Hybrids, and this guy has examined literally thousands of skulls, and he wrote a paper. And what was interesting about this, he thought right from the get-go that something was wrong here, that it was genetic. And he asked me to
like a deformed person?
Well, he thought it was genetic that was carried through. And he said, you know, there's too many anomalies here. There's no way this is all cradle headboarded. And he posited that the foramen magnum, which is the part at the base of the skull where the spinal column attaches to the head, might be in a different location. Surprise. When we sent him the casts, which are 1-to-1 ratio that Joe Taylor expertly did of the Paracas skulls, along with the picture that we did of the Oregon skull, he came on the record in a formal paper basically stating a couple of things. Number one, the position of the foramen magnum is all wrong. It's further back towards the occipital plate, towards the rear of the skull. Two, it's shaped differently. It's smaller and shaped differently than a normal foramen magnum. And basically, George, that's genetic. You can't cradle a headboard and move the foramen magnum. You can't do that.
And we show that in Watchers 10. It's basically a human skull has more of an oval-shaped foramen magnum, and all of these elongated heads, the opening where the spinal column goes up into the brain is almost completely round and moved towards the back of the brain. And this is also has something to do with balance and stability. If you have that huge head, you can't attach the neck and all of that, all the vertebrae that go with it in the same spot, or you'd be like off balance.
And here's something else that tags team onto that. When I handed this information to Marcia Moore, who's a forensic artist and who did who's done several pictures which I've included in the book, she had no idea of where I was going with this. She has really no Nephilim dog in the hunt, although she's aware of a Nephilim, but not like I am. So she wrote back and she said, you know, the position of the foramen magnum and the fact that it's smaller sort of changes everything. And I believe that these creatures or whatever these beings were would have longer necks, much, much longer than the average human being. Well, what's interesting is when we go back into the biblical prophetic narrative is all these listings of different Nephilim tribes. And I have posited through the years that these Nephilim tribes may, in fact, have different genetic characteristics. The Rephaim, Nephilim, Zanzumim, the Emims. Well, the word for one of the Nephilim tribes is Anakim, like Anakim Skywalker, go figure. And Anakim, translated, means long-necked. The long-necks. Yeah. Now, I'm not saying that these skulls in Peru...
These look like ant creatures.
Well, they're really strange. I mean, there's no doubt about it. Really strange.
And we don't think they were all giants either.
No, we don't think they're all different.
They were different. They're kind of like a strange genetic manipulated being.
Are there bodies attached to them when you got the skulls? Were you able to find the skeleton bodies?
Well, that's sort of the rub, and that's why we would love to do, literally a real bona fide archaeological dig at Machongo's necropolis. And we know what the markers look like now. We know that like thousands of years ago, the way the royal graves were placed with these particular markers, and I'm not going to state this on the air, but we know what they look like. And we've located several of these areas that have never been uncovered. But in order to go back and dig, you've got to have permits. And it's been 3 years just to get DNA samples out. So, you know, I would love to do that. There is a skeleton, actually, that Brian Forrester discovered in an out-of-the-way museum on Lake Titicaca. Literally, they've had one visitor in a year. So it's more or less a hole-in-the-wall room with the skeleton in a plexiglass case. I've seen pictures of it. The skull is greatly elongated. I mean greatly elongated. And it's a complete skeleton. In other words, it was found in a mummy bundle. I've got pictures from the 30s from Peru, and you see these at the Julio Teo Museum in Lima, where they show the mummy bundles, but I've yet to see an intact skeleton. However, back again at the Julio Teo Museum, they have like literally 10,000 skulls and 300 mummy wrappings, and we're desperately, we go back down to get DNA samples, and we're very close right now, George, very close to actually obtaining permits to do that. We're on the last leg of the journey, so to speak. One of our dreams is to get into the museum with the archaeologist that we're using to be able to see some of the mummy bundles, some of the full-length skeletons, see what we're looking at there.
L.A., what does your gut tell you what these creatures might be or these entities?
Well, the hypothesis has been right from the get-go that 3,500 years ago, when Joshua and Caleb went into what is known as the Levant, or the land of the promised land, or the land of Canaan, Nephilim tribes were there. And not all of them were giants. Like the long-necks, the Anakim, may have just looked like the Paracas people, just very, very strange bodies. But they were not giants. But giants were there, too. And that's why the Rephaim, Nephilim, Zanzumim, Anakim, all these different names of Nephilim tribes, I believe, denote different genetic characteristics. And the hypothesis has always been there was a diaspora 3,500 years ago. And if that's the case, we should find evidence of it. And in my opinion, and we talked about this in Watchers 6, and certainly definitely in Watchers 10, they're there. That the evidence seems to be overwhelming, not only in the artifacts, but in what our work was on Catalina. And anybody who uncovers this stuff, there's immediately a cover-up. And we talk about this, of course, in Watchers 10.
L.A., we're going to take a break and come back for more. Plus, we're going to talk about a picture we had up on the coasttocoastam.com website, a little creature that's in Watchers 10. Very controversial. We'll be back. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. L.A. Marzulli with us, Richard Shaw. We're talking about their latest work, Watchers 10 DNA. L.A., last week we had a very strange picture up, something that Jaime Masson has been working on for years. kept you under wraps with it because this story is in Watchers 10. Let's talk about this little tiny creature. What the heck is this?
I got to tell you the backstory real quick, George, because it was just incredible. When we went down there to film Watcher 7, the interview Jaime, we're sitting downstairs. Jaime's got like a offices in a four-story building. So we're down in the lower floor, and Jaime appears in this balcony. Marzulli Shaw, come up. So we go bounding up the spiral staircase. And Jaime takes us into his office, and, you know, we've never been there before. And he goes, I'm filming a TV program. I'll be right down. In the meantime, look at this. And he reaches up to this to the cabinet and pulls down this jar and sets it on his desk. And we look at this thing, and Jaime goes bounding out of the room and waves to us and goes up the stairs out of sight. And here we are. We're left with this creature in the jar. And I just looked at Richard. We looked at each other with, you've got to be kidding me, kind of a look. And there it was. Richard calls it the fairy. I call it the winged nightmare. And we picked this thing up, not out of the jar, but we picked up the jar and began to look at it.
How tall was it?
It was about 9 to 10 inches.
Okay.
It has wings. It's black leather, black leathery skin. It's got fangs protruding from lips which curl back in a sneer. His eyes are closed. It's got hands. It's got feet.
It has pointy ears.
Pointy ears.
Did it look? Did it look plastic?
No.
What did it look like?
It looked very real. And we were freaked because it was the first thing I thought of was, oh my gosh, this looks like what comes out of the abyss, which we read about in the book of Revelation,
yeah,
which is a freaky book. That's what it looked like to me.
And it had wings?
Had wings.
Did you see any organs, body parts?
No, we did not
you
see
could
anything
not.
Like that. But they had, the thing wasn't a solution of formaldehyde. And apparently they had opened it up and taken some of those things out. What was interesting, the day we were there, they had the geneticist who worked on the creature, and this is all in Watchers 10. We've held this footage for 3 years, true to our word, and then Jaime allowed us to release it. And the geneticist who did the early sampling of this thing basically was just blown away by what they didn't find, sort of thing. That day we were there, they took the creature out and did x-rays. And they bought the x-rays back, and we were really perplexed as to what we were looking at. And about 3 months ago, actually 2 months ago, Jaime gave us a copy of the x-rays. And when I saw the x-rays again, I was leaning towards hoax. I was saying, man, what are these round, like, hot spots in the radiograph?
Right.
And we didn't know what they were. And I was going, well, maybe this is how they put this thing together. But what was weird here, George, it was, no, they're too asymmetrical. It's like they're not. We didn't know what they were till I took the picture. So I took the X-rays, the copy of the X-rays, to a veterinarian, and I sat down with him and I said, "Okay, here." And he wouldn't come on the record.
Either. Is that what's on the back of the cover?
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. He wouldn't come on the record. With his face, he didn't want to be filmed. But he did come on with an audio interview, which is of course in Watchers 10. And basically what he stated was this, that yes, he had seen these hot spots on the x-rays, and they were BBs. And we just went, you have got to be kidding me. What do you mean by BBs? And he said, you know, like buckshot, birdshot, and all of a sudden...
Somebody took a shotgun to it.
Exactly. And we were completely blown away.
At that point, we knew that this thing had to have been flying around,
yeah,
and had to come down where it was picked up along the side of the road by a 13-year-old boy, and that's how Jaime got it, was because of that.
Did he have to buy it?
I think he eventually paid some money for it. He didn't tell us how much.
Yeah, but not like a six-figure sum or anything.
That wasn't like the kid's primary purpose. He just didn't know what it was and wanted to get it to Jaime. I mean, if you lost some baggage in the airport there in Mexico, and it had Jaime's name on it, it would somehow get to him because everybody there knows him.
Everybody knows him. That's right. Now, has anybody done any DNA sample on this little thing?
Well, we were able to take DNA sampling out, very, very small samples. We did it twice. The first time it was confiscated by the TSA. The second time we...
The TSA took the samples or the creature?
The samples. No, Jaime's got the creature. Jaime's got the creature. Creature's fine. The sample was confiscated by the TSA. The second batch that we were able to get out, very, very minute samples, both labs were not able to extract any DNA at all because this thing had been immersed in formaldehyde. Both labs that we sent the samples to had no idea what they were testing, but they could not extract. Since then, we told them that this, whatever this thing was, it was immersed in formaldehyde. One of the labs believes that it may be able to extract DNA because there's a protocol that they use to treat the sample when it's been immersed in formaldehyde. So we're still on the trail. What's interesting, getting back to the veterinarian, now this is a guy who's trained in anatomy, and anatomy of certainly more than one animal, birds and elephants. I mean, they look at everything because they have to. Who knows what you're going to do with
right.
the vet? Who knows what's going to come across, you know, in your office in the morning, right? And I look at the guy and I said, look, could this be a composite? And he looked very carefully at the x-rays, and we discussed how the wings were attached. We looked at the tail and the barb at the end of the tail, which was really strange. We looked at the skull formation with the teeth and the arms. And
again, the head is a little tiny thing, right?
Well, the head is small, but it's in proportion to the rest of the body.
Right.
It's about an inch and a quarter tall. And it has an actual, if you look at the x-ray, there's an actual cranial signature, like a normal kind of skull.
I mean, it looks somewhat human outside of the wings, doesn't it?
Yeah, and if you look at a profile of the skull, you can see the teeth in the x-ray hanging down, and they're big. I mean, it has, like, large teeth for the size of the face that it has. And then there's, like, a bone behind the skull area on its back where the wings connect that's thicker, and that looks totally normal, like this is the way this thing is put together.
And George, the vet came on the record stating that in his professional opinion, this was not a composite. I've also had, we just got back from a conference in Colorado, which was fantastic, but I had two hunters come up and look at the x-rays, and there was no collusion between either of them. They came up to the table at different times. They took one look at the x-ray. They asked me, how tall was this thing? I said around 9 inches, 9, 10 inches. They said, that's number 7 birdshot, and the thing was killed between 50 and 75 feet away. Either, you know, these guys know. They both said number seven birdshot. Instantly, bam, that's
yeah, that's not. Is it a mythical fairy? What is this thing?
Well, if I'm going to weigh in on this, I would say that this, whatever this thing is, it leads back, in my opinion, it leads back to what we read about in the book of Revelation, where this thing, this place called the Abyss is opened up, and out of this thing come these winged creatures, and then their tails, they have the power to sting men and women on the earth, and their sting is like a scorpion, and that's exactly what this thing looks like. It's got a tail. Oh. And a stinger. And in the x-ray, you can see it's not bone in the tail. It's cartilage.
And
it's
the stinger looks like a scorpion stinger tail, very similar to that, except it looks a bit more like a cat's claw. It's like curved with a pointy end on it attached to this tail.
Well, it looks ghoulish.
I agree.
I mean, it would... imagine this thing flying at you.
Oh my gosh.
And making facial expressions on its way towards you. Well, I mean, because it has a face that looks very human.
Yes, exactly. So what we don't know, too, is one, is it a baby or a full-grown adult? And two, what about the sex?
That we don't know, except that I would think that this is pretty much, from what people have told us that have seen these things flying around at night, at various places, and we won't get into where we've been told they've been seen, but they can have a wingspan that's about a foot wide, and they make quite a bit of racket when they're flying because this thing is kind of big and it has to stay aloft.
You would think it was a bat if you quickly saw it fly by, I think.
Well, the wings are fleshy, you know, they're thinner than bat wings. Bat wings are, there's more tissue there than what's in this. The wings on this I would guess LA, I guess we would say they're semi-transparent.
Yeah, they're semi-transparent. One of the forensic clues that we got from this thing, and this blew us away, when the veterinarian looked at it, there's a break on the left leg, down around the tibia, the lower part of the leg, for lack of a better word, the tibia. Okay.
On the left leg.
On the left leg, and there's a you can clearly see it. There's a break, and above the break, there's this again a white ball, but it's not a ball. It's been smeared, and the veterinarian said that's birdshot, and that is more than likely the break is from the birdshot. And all of a sudden, it cleared up forensically what we had been wondering about. And the x-rays, by the way, have been passed on just over the weekend to a forensic anthropologist, as well as one of a leading radiologist in the United States. So, you know, we're still on the trail here. But the reason why we went with it, basically because of the veterinarian. Once he cleared up what we were looking at in the x-rays and came on the record stating that in his professional opinion, this was not a composite. He could see joints, he could see the femur, he could see where everything was put together. He told me, you know, point blank, if this is a hoax, you know, it's done really, really well.
It's a great hoax.
Yeah, and I don't think it is, and that's why we went with it.
I mean, he talked about details, like the joint space between the hip and the pelvic area and how the rib cage attaches to the sternum. And he said, I can see all of that in the x-ray. I mean, just like a normal creature would have.
Were the wings almost butterfly-like?
No, in my opinion, they were more bat-like, but they were, and they weren't transparent, but they were very, you know, gossamer wings. I mean, they were very, very, very thin, very thin membrane.
And of course, it may have looked different at one time before it was soaked in formaldehyde. I mean, if this could have been, you know, put into liquid nitrogen or something like that, would have a better idea of what it actually looked like, but that wasn't possible for Jaime at the time to do that.
L.A., weren't devils described in the Bible as having wings?
Well, I mean, that's not really. I mean, none of these creatures, as far as I know, are described that way. In Revelation 9, there is this thing, like I mentioned, that does come out of the abyss. And there are similarities, in my opinion. The first time I saw the thing, I went, oh, my gosh, that looks like what comes out of the abyss. That's what came out of my mouth, being a student of, you know, the biblical prophetic narrative.
Right.
Well, yeah, in Revelation 9:7, it says their faces resemble human faces. And
right.
This thing definitely resembles a human face.
And the body, other than the wings, is almost human-looking, isn't it?
Very much so. And the teeth are like the teeth of a lion. They're very sharp and very long.
Now, this thing you said was in a jar of formaldehyde?
Correct.
I would assume the texture of the body would be soft. Did anybody feel it?
I didn't pick it up.
Kind of, you know, if it's been in, you know, liquid for a long time, it would be kind of spongy, I would think.
Well, yeah, another reason that we don't think this is a composite or something that someone glued together or put together, first of all, you would see that in the x-ray. And secondly, it wouldn't have held together all these years in a jar of formaldehyde. The liquid would have caused it to eventually come apart, in my opinion. And it's still intact after all these years being immersed in the liquid.
It's weird. You know, we had this picture up on the website last week. And you've got this incredible video in Watchers 10. What are people saying about it?
Well, it's all over the map. I mean, basically the naysayers are saying, oh, you know, it's a hoax. It's just, we've seen these before. Ha, ha, ha. And I've written back on my YouTube channel, and I just said, look, we were there. We went to the vet. We've seen the x-rays. You haven't. So,
you thought it could have been a hoax originally, right?
That's what I lean to. I just went, you know, I'm not going to get fooled here. And once we got the x-rays and we were able to take those to a trained professional, and I sat down with this guy and all that, we have the audio of it. It's in, and that's a riveting interview. And he stated, you know, sort of nervously that if it was a hoax, it was done really, really well. But here's the deal, George, no one's profiting from this. I mean, you know, people go, oh, you know, they sold books, they sold DVDs. It's not like we're, you know, going to retire in the South Pacific here from this. it's not happening.
Well, then this is not the entire Watcher series. It's just a small little facet of it.
Exactly.
That's right. And the other thing is that I think the one thing that will really prove that if this thing was really shot down is to determine if those little spots, metal spots in the X-ray are made out of lead. If so, then that's even more proof.
That's
so
right.
That's what we want to do is to get it in the SEM chamber and do EDX analysis, is energy dispersant X-ray spectroscopy, which basically gives you an idea of what kind of percentage of the elements are in there, and we can drill right into that with the beam, and it'll tell us what it's made of. So that's what we have to do. That's the next thing. But that means we have to get the creature into the U.S.
Right. When do you think the creature might have been shot down?
What did Jaime say, 13 years ago?
Yeah, I thought, 11 or 13 years ago.
So they're still out there then. If these are real, it's probably still out there. There's probably a number of them.
Well, his stories, he said this boy was traveling from Guadalajara into Mexico and found it along the side of the road. So, I mean, if we knew where that area was, we could go back and see if there's any more.
Or find the shooter.
Yeah, find the shooter. That would be like...
That would be incredible.
Oh, man, what if the guy said they were coming at me like crazy, hundreds of them?
One of the hunters, George, came up with a real interesting idea. Scenario of how this thing might have been shot. He said, down there in Mexico, they have a real problem with doves.
Thugs.
Doves.
Doves. Like, birds.
Like a flock of birds.
Okay.
And he says that farmers will just shoot at the flock to try to, call the flock and keep them off the crop. And then he said something which I had never thought of. He said, perhaps this thing was hunting in the flock of doves, and that's why it was shot. Now, that's a scenario. It's certainly a plausible
one. Or maybe it attacked somebody.
Exactly. Either one.
I also wonder if they had the kind of intelligence, if they're more human than animal, to have, like, little weapons and things like that.
Yeah, that's where it gets really scary.
Yeah, because it has actual hands with five fingers and arms.
And toes,
well,
too?
Yeah, toes.
Toes, yeah. It has feet, it has legs. It has hands and arms, and then it has wings.
It looks like it has a little rib cage.
It does.
Yeah.
And so it by virtue of the fact of the type of teeth it has, it's definitely a meat eater.
Carnivore. Definitely.
And what if these things come up to you, fly on you, and bite you?
It'd be very unpleasant.
Jeez.
Bedtime story.
A 9-inch insect biting away at your neck or something like that.
Yeah. Terrifying.
It's an amazing discovery. Hey, when we come back at the top of the hour, I want to talk about a story that we had on this program 8 years ago. It was the Afghan giant, which you highlight in Watchers 10. Let's do that. Did that story startle you, L.A., when you first heard it?
Absolutely. Are you talking about the Afghan giant?
I
sat there with, you've got to be kidding me. And, can't wait to talk about this.
Okay, we're going to do that. And again, where do people pick up Watchers 10, Richard?
Well, if you go to that piece on the ferry on Coast to Coast website, there's an email address at the end of it, or you can click on either L.A. Marzulli or pinlight.com, and there's you can click to order on either one of our sites.
Super. And the websites are linked up at coasttocoastam.com as well. We're going to come back. Final hour to go. We're going to talk about an Afghan giant. And then we're going to take your calls for the rest of the hour here on Coast to Coast AM.